Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a venue for spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. The annual Citizen University Conference brings together community leaders, artists, and activists to discuss the art and practice of citizenship. Their motto is, "Let's do democracy." The gathering evolved out of the work of the Guiding Lights Network, founded by author and educator Eric Liu in 2005. The theme this year was Citizen Power Now. To that end, participants focused on best practices for problem solving in a climate of political polarization. The closing plenary session on day two featured poet Claudia Rankine and playwright Robert Shankin. Both read from their work and joined Eric Liu in conversation. Claudia Rankine has published several poetry collections. Her latest, Citizen, an American Lyric, was a finalist for the National Book Award and winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award in Poetry. Rankine is a chancellor of the Academy of American Poets and professor of English at Pomona College. Robert Shankin is an American playwright, screenwriter, and actor. He received the Pulitzer Prize for Drama in 1992 for his work, The Kentucky Cycle. His play, All the Way, earned the 2014 Tony Award for Best Play. The Citizen University National Conference took place at Seattle Center on March 20th and 21st, 2015. Sponsors included Seattle Center, the Seattle Foundation, and KUOW 94.9. Thanks to Anna Tatashev for our recording.
Being in the company of Claudia Rankine and Robert Shankin is a remarkable thing. Because of the body of work that each of these two people has created over time, and because of the incredible, beautiful, often painful relevance of their body of work to our moment. Claudia, as you have read in your bios in the program, is a poet, happens to be, as of just a couple of weeks ago, the winner of the 2014 National Book Critics Circle Award for Poetry for this book, Citizen, an American Lyric. Robert Shankin, an author, playwright, whose work is very visibly recently in the mix, most recently, as I described, having won the 2014 Tony Award for Best Play for a play called All the Way, which is the first in a pair of plays coupled with The Great Society that are about LBJ and that period of history, the Civil Rights era, the Vietnam era, the Great Society era. Robert's work prior to that, a play for which he won the Pulitzer Prize, is called The Kentucky Cycle. And we're going to talk about that probably as well a little bit. The Kentucky Cycle is a set of nine plays, I believe, short plays, that when performed together run something like 6 hours, is that right? 6 hours that cover the same...
It goes by in 15 minutes.
Goes by in 15 minutes. That is about a patch of ground in Kentucky and the people who live there from 1775 all the way through the 1970s and these different fragments of perception and history and all the themes that we've been talking about today about the arguments and tensions of American identity. So with that, I really think, you know, the beauty and the power, as I was saying earlier before we went to breakouts, about thinking of ourselves as citizen artists begins with examples. And we have here two exemplars. And I really just wanted to invite both Claudia and Robert first to describe, for those of you who don't know these most recent works of theirs, to say a word or two about these works. And Claudia, if you would just tell us what this book, Citizen, is and how it came to be.
Well, first I want to thank you, Eric, for inviting me. You know how there's something out there in the world and you don't know you're missing it until you arrive? I have just had that experience. And now I'm going to always be here, whenever it is, wherever it is. I have met... It's just been so enlightening and soul-feeding. So I just want to thank you all. Yesterday, Hai-Jen said something. She said that she wanted to bring private conversations into a public arena. And so for me, Citizen was that. I went around and I asked friends to tell me moments that one could label as microaggressions, moments where you were in a relationship with someone, a friend, a colleague, and race entered the room and totally threw away any form of intimacy that had existed prior. Just a moment of racism. And the reason I wanted to do that was, again and again around the dinner table, some microaggression would happen. Some black man was killed. Evacuees were left in arenas in Katrina. And we kept saying, how is that happening? How could that happen in the United States? And then I thought, well, somehow we're making it happen. We're allowing it to happen. And so it's not about going to white supremacists and asking them, why did you do this? They're not doing it. We're doing it. And so I wanted to see how positions around race underlined our day-to-day interactions and how racism was really actually a part of the fabric of what made us Americans. So that was the sort of impetus behind putting together this book.
In a moment or two, I'm going to ask you to share a selection or two from Citizen. But Robert, tell us both about these two plays, All the Way and The Great Society, and similarly, the genesis for this project.
There are two plays, All the Way and The Great Society. All the Way traces the first term of the accidental president, LBJ, who ascends to the office after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, November 63 to November 64. It, to me, is a hinge point in American history. This is the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which is the death knell for Jim Crow. And it's also the point at which racism, which had been overtly institutionalized, goes underground. It's the point at which the language of racism changes and becomes codified. It is the emergence of the Southern strategy, the modern Republican Party, the loss of the Democratic South. It is the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. It's the murder of the three Mississippi workers. It is the beginning of the Vietnam War. There is one moment where sometimes history throws you a softball, and this is one of those where in the same 24 hours where LBJ is waiting to hear whether they found all three bodies of the murdered civil rights workers, and he is simultaneously planning essentially to lie to the American public about the Gulf of Tonkin. And so what you have is the uncovering of one murder, of these three young men, and the decision which will result in the burial of thousands and thousands of young men and women. It's kind of a shocking. So these plays are an attempt to come to terms with the events of 1964 and then following forward into finally March 68th when Johnson announces that he will not run for president.
You know, this phrase that you've just used, Robert, an attempt to come to terms, is profound, and it's key to the work that both of you do. I'm wondering, for both of you, whether specifically about these works, Citizen or All the Way and The Great Society, or just in your work in general, at what point in your work and process does that impulse and that need to come to terms with history and its legacy actually convert to the decision to make art, to express that impulse and that need in the way that you two are able to express?
At what point? Because that's what I do, because I write, I don't think there's ever a conscious moment where the information and the interrogation of something that's happening in the world has to move over into art. For me, that's the way I address it. That's the way I interrogate it. That's the way it becomes formed in my imagination in terms, not an answer, but in terms of an unpacking of it.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. I see my own work as a provocation, as a series of questions that I hope to pose in a way that challenges the audience, provokes them to think about these issues, perhaps in a way that they haven't. It's not me providing answers. It's not me telling them how they should feel about this or what they should do with this information, but to put it out there in a way that they can grapple with, that is visceral. It strikes an emotional chord, and it also hopefully engages them intellectually as well.
You know, Claudia, when you were describing how this kind of one way to conceptualize your book, Citizen, is to think about it as documenting microaggressions in different forms, these moments when race enters the room or enters the dynamic. The beauty and the power of this book, which is so forceful, is that several things. One, it's as fine-grained a texture of depiction of human seeing and human blindness as I have encountered, not just on topics of race, but just, period. And the other thing that is striking to me about it is how much of it is about themes we've been discussing over this weekend about recognition and dignity and assumptions and the boxes that we put one another in. I'm wondering if you might want to share a selection from Citizen to give everybody in the room a sense of what we're talking about here.
I'm going to read a piece, and I should say that the way this book, there's a quote by Romer Brearden, the collagist. He said, there are all kinds of people, and they will help you if you let them. And so the stories in this book were collected, as I said before. And I went to a friend who's a black lawyer in LA, and I said to him, can you tell me times when you were pulled over by the police? And so what I'm going to read to you is a kind of mashup of incidents into one piece. I knew whatever was in front of me was happening, and then the police vehicle came to a screeching halt in front of me, like they were setting up a blockade. Everywhere were flashes, a siren sounding, and a stretched out roar, get on the ground. Get on the ground now. Then I just knew. And you're not the guy, and still you fit the description, because there is only one guy who is always the guy fitting the description. I left my client's house knowing I would be pulled over. I knew, I just knew. I opened my briefcase on the passenger seat just so they could see. Yes, officer, rolled around on my tongue, which grew out of a bell that could never ring because its emergency was a tolling I was meant to swallow. In a landscape drawn from an ocean bed, you can't drive yourself sane. So angry, you are crying. You can't drive yourself sane. This motion wears a guy out. Our motion is wearing you out. And still, you're not the guy. Then flashes, a siren, a stretched out roar. And you're not the guy, and still you fit the description, because there is only one guy who is always the guy fitting the description. Get on the ground. Get on the ground now. I must have been speeding. No, you weren't speeding. I wasn't speeding. You didn't do anything wrong. Then why are you pulling me over? Why am I pulled over? Put your hands where they can be seen. Put your hands in the air. Put your hands up. Then you're stretched out on the hood, then cuffed. Get on the ground now. Each time it begins in the same way, it doesn't begin the same way. Each time it begins, it's the same. Flashes, a siren, the stretched out roar. maybe, because home was a hood the officer could not afford, not that a reason was needed. I was pulled out of my vehicle a block from my door, handcuffed and pushed into the police vehicle's back seat, the officer's knee pressing into my collarbone, the officer's warm breath vacating a face creased into the smile of its own private joke. Each time it begins in the same way. It doesn't begin the same way. Each time it begins, it's the same. Go ahead and hit me, mother f***, fled my lips, and the officer did not need to hit me. The officer did not need anything from me except the look on my face on the drive across town. You can't drive yourself sane. You're not insane. Our motion is wearing you out. You're not the guy. This is what it looks like. You know this is wrong. This is not what it looks like. You need to be quiet. This is wrong. You need to close your mouth now. This is what it looks like. Why are you talking if you haven't done anything wrong? And you're not the guy. And still you fit the description, because there is only one guy who is always the guy fitting the description. In a landscape drawn from an ocean bed, you can't drive yourself sane. So angry, you can't drive yourself sane. The charge the officer decided on was exhibition of speed. I was told after the fingerprinting to stand naked. I stood naked. It was only then I was instructed to dress, to leave, to walk all those miles back home. And still, you're not the guy. And still you fit the description, because there is only one guy who is always the guy fitting the description.
Claudia, thank you. I'm one of the phrases that's been ringing in my mind since last night during our conversation that we had with activists from Seattle and from Ferguson was one that I believe Rubin used. I can't remember exactly. The logic of power. The logic of power. And part of what is so powerful about the entirety of Citizen, but particularly that piece you just read, is the contorted, inward-turning logic of the illogic,
right?
The ways in which you say you cannot drive yourself sane. And one of the things that I think we have been hearing and feeling throughout this weekend is that the illogic of the logic of power, certainly on race, but on other aspects of our identity as well, plays out 1,000 times a day in ways that go unnamed, unremarked upon, and undocumented. Even if you are a poet, even if you are an artist. And one of the things that is so important about waking us up to the invisible inherited logic of power as people have given it to us up to this point is recognizing from time to time where we stand in history. And so, Robert, your phrase a moment ago about these hinge points in history is also reverberating in my mind. And, you know, I guess one of the things that I'm curious about is, you know, these plays, which you wrote over many years, have been produced on Broadway here in Seattle at the Seattle Rep at the time of Michael Brown, at the time of Eric Garner, at the time of Tamir Rice, right? At the time of the erosion of the Voting Rights Act, at the time of the commemoration of the Voting Rights Act, right? What have you been learning about the ways in which these two plays have been landing in this moment right now in history?
Well, they have done what I hoped they might do, which is enter a national conversation about race, about American politics, about presidential power, about legislative gridlock. A conversation about the stories we tell ourselves about who we are and how we think we work. One of the advantages to a so-called history play, the taking of an event that your audience assumes some knowledge of and dramatizing it, is it enables you to have the kind of conversation that sometimes you can't have if you try to have it overtly, if you try to have it directly. But by taking this event that is in our past and that we all have some understanding of or knowledge of, and then juxtaposing the events of the theatrical performance with that information, you create this really interesting dissonance that forces people to try to reconcile that for themselves. So it has been a very enlightening experience for me as an artist and as someone who was politically involved to see how it lands with people and what kinds of conversations it generates.
You know, you just spoke about the ways in which the plays capture or awaken in us through that kind of strategy of indirection, the stories we tell ourselves to make sense of why we do what we do, right? LBJ is, of course, the central figure in both these plays, particularly All the Way, which charts his life from accidentally becoming president to his election in his own right in November 64. There's a monologue in All the Way, an LBJ monologue, that captures a bit of this sense of how everybody, citizens, whether they are presidents or not, like to make sense of their past, their own personal past, as a justification for what they try to do in the world going forward. I wonder if you could share that with us.
Yeah. This is LBJ, the 1964 Civil Rights Bill, landmark legislation, has finally gotten to the floor of the Senate, and the leader of the Dixiecrats, the group that is unalterably opposed to civil rights, Senator Russell of Georgia, has just announced a filibuster. And this has heretofore always been the death knell for civil rights legislation in the U.S. Senate. And Russell has had a press conference in which he's announced his defiance. And this is LBJ's response. This is LBJ in all of his racial crudity and all of his racial insight into American politics. Defending the Constitution. Let me tell you what we're really talking about here. My first year out of college, the only job I could get was teaching first grade in a beat-up old elementary school in Cotulla, Texas, a dusty border town in the middle of nowhere full of wetback Mexicans who didn't have a pot to piss in. But God, did I love those kids. They would show up every morning dirty, ragged, and hungry because most of them hadn't had breakfast, but they were so on fire to learn that it just made you feel good. But for each one of them, there would come a day when I would see the light in their eyes die because they had discovered that the world hated them just because of the color of their skin. All my life as a Southerner, I've had to bite my tongue on this issue till my mouth was full of blood. Well, no more. What's the point of being president if you can't do what you know is right? This ain't about the Constitution. This is about those who got more wanting to hang on to what they got at the expense of those who got nothing and feel good about it. Uncle Dick can talk all about his rights till he's blue in the face, but all I see are the faces of those little kids in Cotulla. He's right about one thing, though. The war has just begun.
It's a really striking monologue in the production. And by the way, I should mention the Tony Award-winning production of All the Way starred as LBJ, not Robert Shanken, but Bryan Cranston of Breaking Bad. And he will be reprising that role in an HBO production of the play that is in development right now. So that's going to be some exciting television coming up soon. One thing that a question that I'd like to pose to both of you is just about this notion of the citizen as artist. You've been talking about yourselves as artists and the way that you approach your work and the ways in which your work lands. For those of us in the room here who may or may not, well, for those of us in the room who may not call ourselves artists by vocation, by profession, what can you share with everybody here about how to import and take in the artist's sensibility and apply it to our lives as citizens, whether on issues of race or on issues of class or issues of injustice, inequity, whatever it may be, the artist's sensibility as applied to the lives of lay citizens who may not today think of themselves in those terms. Robert, do you want to go first?
Sure. I'm a storyteller. That's who I am. That's what I do. And everybody in this room is a storyteller. That is the warp and weave of our constant interactions with each other. How are you? What did you do today? What happened? Did you hear about my mom? Did you know what my boyfriend did? I mean, that's how we exchange with another, with each other, is stories. And the artist's life is an examined life. And so I would say, in terms of how does an individual who doesn't consider themselves an artist incorporate that, it's by examining in a more conscious way the stories that you have accepted about who you are or what you do, and the stories you tell about who you are and what you do. I think we have no choice over the story we're handed when we're born, but we have complete choice over the story we decide to tell about who we are and the stories that we hand down. So that's how I would answer.
Thank you, Claudia.
Voila. I think going off of that, I would say it's, you know, Mauricio talked about listening. And I think as an artist, what you learn to do is listen deeply and listen outwardly and listen to what is being said, which is sometimes different from what is being communicated. And to be able to sort of traffic back and forth in, and that's really a way of talking about different stories. You know, often the story that's being presented and the story that's being told are very different. And so I think the way that we can all move into the realm of the creative is to understand that all the stories are created, as you were saying. They're all created. And so we're all creatively moving forward inside those stories. So to listen and to retell in ways that that recognize, in ways that sees the person in front of you and allows that to somehow open out the story into everybody else's story.
Can I just add one thing? Because there was something that happened this morning in the group of students who got up very early, and this young man told us a very powerful story about the murder of a family member. And then he shifted the narrative. He changed the story. And just when he started to talk about the other young man who had murdered his cousin, he said, you know, and I thought about him as a victim. And I thought about what his life might... That's where the story shifts. He shifted the story there. Mm-hmm. And it was so profound, that shift, that movement. It cracked it open, and it suddenly became... Possibilities tumbled out as a result of his changing his point of view there on terms of who is this character mm-hmm. who has entered. He's a murderer. No, yes, he is, but he's also a victim too. What does that do? I just thought it was so powerful. Yeah. It was really moving.
There's one other thing, Claudia, that strikes me about what both of you are saying here, that I think is another skill when you think about this combination of storytelling and deep, compassionate listening as foundational skills of citizenship, foundational skills of finding one's civic voice and power, right? Things that all of you have been doing with one another all weekend long. A third thing pops in mind to my mind just listening to you too, which is the skill and the practice of connecting dots, of making associations, right, between things that might not initially at first glance seem to be associated, and the juxtaposition. All during the breakout sessions, I was kind of dipping in and sampling each of them so I could get a sense of how all of them were going. And just during this afternoon session, I jotted down three little fragments of phrase from three different breakout sessions. One was the free world. The free world is a phrase that used to be said a lot during the Cold War when there was the communist world and the free world, and the president was called the leader of the free world. But that phrase wasn't used that way today. It was used in a clip from Lynn Novick's film about prison education, where a young man who was in prison but heading out soon was reflecting on how he had spent more of his life in prison than in the free world. And that phrase just stuck with me, and I thought, boy, different people mean different things by the free world. There was another phrase, actually, in the workshop on Benjamin Franklin clubs and simple virtues and the practice of virtues. And I'm not even sure what the virtue was that was in discussion, but I think it had something to do with deciding simply to start a habit that would be beneficial to you. And the joking example that was used was one of the participants in the breakout session describing how after an awful breakup, he'd read somewhere that he needed to take even small steps to create new routines. And the guy had never been a particularly regular flosser. And so he decided in the wake of this awful breakup, gosh darn it, I'm going to start flossing every night. And he did, and he still does. Right? And then the third little fragment was in the breakout session led by the FII families, where they were talking about what they were calling the peer effect, but what we have also been talking about today and experiencing as simply the contagiousness of social norms, right? And the piece that caught me there that I jotted down was about how social science is showing today that your friends' friends' behaviors, actions, feelings affect you. If your friends' friends are obese, you are more likely to be obese. If your friends' friends are happy, you are more likely to be happy. If your friends' friends smoke, you are more likely to smoke. That it's not just the obvious first-order effects of these contagion, but these second-order and third-order effects, right? You take these three little fragments of the free world and flossing and kind of the simple habits and practices and this notion of the contagion, and what you get are three little dots that you can connect a lot of different ways, right? And just spending time in the company of Robert and Claudia makes me that much more open to wanting to make those kinds of associations and connections. There's another segment in Citizen, Claudia, that maybe this would be a good time to share that, that is itself a product of that kind of association making and just another aspect of your voice.
This piece is, though many of the pieces in Citizen were gathered from talking to and listening to others, this piece actually happened to me. And there's a phrase that came up here, I think, yesterday, when black people say, it's not my job to educate white people. And I don't actually like that phrase, because I feel that institutional racism has gotten us all in a bind, black people and white people. And so I included this piece because it was a moment when I saw myself behaving in a way that I didn't like. You and your partner go to see the film The House We Live In. You ask a friend to pick up your child from school. On your way home, your phone rings. Your neighbor tells you he is standing at his window watching a menacing black guy casing both your homes. The guy is walking back and forth, talking to himself, and seems disturbed. You tell your neighbor that your friend, whom he has met, is babysitting. He says, no, it's not him. He's met your friend, and this isn't that nice young man. Anyway, he wants you to know, he's called the police. Your partner calls your friend and asks him if there's a guy walking back and forth in front of your home. Your friend says that if anyone were outside, he would see him because he is standing outside. You hear the sirens through the speakerphone. Your friend is speaking to your neighbor when you arrive home. The four police cars are gone. Your neighbor has apologized to your friend and is now apologizing to you. Feeling somewhat responsible for the actions of your neighbor, you clumsily tell your friend that the next time he wants to talk on the phone, he should just go in the backyard. He looks at you a long minute before saying he can speak on the phone wherever he wants. Yes, of course, you say. Yes, of course. But for me, that piece was a moment when my attempt to care for my friend was to get him out of harm's way. And in the attempt to get him out of harm's way, I was limiting his freedom. And it took a second to understand the mistake the moment it came out of my mouth. But when he looked at me like, you too are going to limit my freedom? It was one of those moments. So I think racism has gotten us all tangled up. And the other thing about this friend is he was in prison for 20 years. So if just a little thing went wrong with the police, they weren't going to listen to him. And he would have been back in. So that, you know, so this is the way the black body is negotiating step by step in this country.
Thank you, Claudia. This... The way the black body, the way bodies, and by the way, this is something that when you read Citizen, you will feel the texture of too. The phrase, the word, the idea of the body recurs over and over again in this work, because this is embodied stuff. This is not just in our heads. This is not just theory. This is not just hashtag. This is in our bodies and our choices and our even involuntary reactions and actions. Robert, one of the things that, again, coming back to the role of history, you know, I am so struck by so many of the resonances, and you describe the way in which a play like All the Way can be used actually to crack open conversations that are harder to come at directly right now, right? And we heard on stage last night, we've heard throughout the kind of perpetual tug of war between those who want to work within a traditional process, a traditional system of power, and those who are impatient with that, between those who want to focus solely on what Ijen was speaking about, the power of love, the nonviolent power of care, and those who want to mix it up more, right? You were alluding earlier to one of the kind of ironic signal moments in LBJ's life that is captured in the play, the day that he's learning about the murder of the three civil rights workers in Mississippi. And there is a powerful scene in All the Way where the setting is the funeral of one of those civil rights workers. and MLK is speaking at that funeral. And I thought perhaps it might be a good moment right now for us to enact that scene.
James Cheney gave his life to make this country live up to its forgotten promises and unfulfilled ideals. We all know the dark and savage history of Mississippi. We all know the terror and the violence you have endured here. We all know the terrible sadness you feel today in your hearts. But we will not live in despair. We will not surrender. We will continue to respond to this violence with love and forgiveness. And we will succeed with our struggle because you...
That's enough.
No, it's all right.
I am sick and tired of going to funerals for black men who have been murdered by white men. Are you sick and tired of this stuff like I am?
Sick and tired.
I'm not feeling sad tonight, Dr. King. I'm not feeling sorrowful. I'm not feeling forgiveness. I got vengeance in my heart. And I ask you to be angry with me. Are you angry?
Yes.
Are you? You yes, tell me what I'm feeling in my heart. Because I'm feeling vengeance in my heart. The white men who murdered James Cheney are never going to be punished.
Never.
I ask you to be sick and tired of that. I'm tired of people in this country allowing this to continue to happen.
Preach, brother.
We got to stand up. We got to stand up!
Stand up!
The best way to remember James Cheney is to demand our rights. You hear me? Demand our rights!
Amen.
Hey, don't just look at me and go back and tell folks you've been to a nice service. Your job, your work, is just beginning. If you go home and you sit down and take what these white people in Mississippi are doing to us, if you take it and don't do something about it, then goddamn your soul.
Preach it.
Stand up.
Stand up.
We got to stand up in Meridian. We got to stand up in Dallas.
Stand up.
And when we get to Atlanta City, what are we going to do?
Stand up.
What are we going to do?
Stand up.
Stand up.
Stand up.
Stand up.
Stand up.
Stand up.
Stand up. Stand up.
Robert, tell us not only about that scene, but about how people have responded to that scene today.
That actually happened at the funeral service for James Cheney. David Dennis, who was a SNCC organizer, field organizer in Mississippi, had a moment. As he describes it, he was standing there listening to this very somber funeral oration, looking at James Cheney's younger brother, who was weeping. And he went off book, and he just spoke from his heart. And it's one of those moments in American history, not just the civil rights movement, but in American history, where things shift. And I have used... David Dennis's words, for the most part, have edited it and shaped the scene. But that is how it played out. And how this played out in theaters all over the country has been astonishing. People don't know for a moment whether the play is being attacked, or there's going to be some sort of protest taking place. They get confused. They turn around. They don't. Some people fall into it and begin shouting alongside him and standing up and demanding action. Other people get very quiet, very intimidated, until we sort of move through the scene and then everybody understands where we are. But it is a moment where I get to shake the proscenium and shake everybody out of this, oh, I'm an audience member watching these events happen. And particularly given the weight of the events of the last 18 months and these terrible, terrible actions, it has resonated in a very powerful way. So,
Claudia, I would like to give you our closing minutes here, just reflecting on some of our conversation, but perhaps also in the same spirit as I was jotting down these things and fragments that that you may have heard and absorbed over the last couple of days. You are such an exceptional listener, an exceptional observer, an exceptional weaver of the strands of conversation and interpretation and embodiment that you encounter. And I just wonder if you would share some closing reflections.
Wow. I think I was speaking earlier to someone that I forget who said this, but someone said, I think it was the young people who were on the stage, but he said that we had to be race brave. And I had never heard that phrase before. And I thought it was fantastic because I think if you move even beyond race into the arena of citizen, and if we could just be citizen brave, if we could understand all the things that I have been understanding during the different talks, that it actually is as simple as you can take yourself and you can make something happen. That you don't have to wait to lead. You are, by being present, a leader. And so I think that's the biggest thing that I have learned in the last 24 hours. So it's not profound. It's simple. It's like we are here, we have a problem, we address the problem. And in addressing the problem from the position of love, from the position of care, the care grid, we can make a difference for a lot of people, for many people, and ultimately for ourselves. So thank you.
Thank you, Claudia. As we close here, I just what Robert was describing happening in theaters across the country during that scene is about as direct a metaphor for our charge now. As we end this conference, engage with one another in new ways, break some more bread, have some drinks, spend some more time with one another if you like, buy some books. But recognizing that moment of confusion, is this the play or is this real life? Am I in the audience or am I an actor? Is this happening or do I just think this is happening? Right? These are the things for us to carry out of this room because it is both a play and it is life. These things are happening and they are not happening. And we are both the audience and we are the actors. And we make art with every action and omission, however seemingly small and not necessarily profound, that we choose to do. And I just want to close the conference, actually, by acknowledging one final piece of art, which is the one that's been in the background here the whole time. Some of you who've been to this conference before have seen this hanging here before. This is a quilt made by a Seattle artist named Luke Haynes. And it was made in a way that was very simple but profound. He went to, a Walmart or maybe a Goodwill, and he found a giant old American flag. It was actually this size. And he didn't know quite what to do with it, but just thought the opportunities that present themselves with a giant American flag. And so he did what an artist does, and what a quilt maker in particular does. He cut it into strips. He sliced it up. He tore apart the fabric that he had inherited. He thought about, when he had this pile of red, white, and blue strips in all different forms, he thought about how he, as an individual, as an artist, as a citizen, and as an American, might reconstitute those strips, might reweave the leavings and the shavings and the pieces that both he and history had cut apart. And he made this piece. And when you look at this piece, you recognize it as the American flag, just like when you heard Paul Rucker this morning, you recognize after a while what he was playing was "My Country, 'Tis of Thee." America. You recognize that. But this flag behind us is, in the end and in the beginning, the message for all of us. Our charge is to think about everyday life, the people we encounter, the objects we encounter, the situations we encounter, as a work for us to claim, appropriate, tear up if we need to, and then reconstitute. And the act of doing that is the greatest form of citizen power. Please join me in thanking Claudia Rankin and Robert Shankin for this conversation. And please join me in thanking all of our speakers for this wonderful conference. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you value this episode or this series, please share your appreciation by posting a good review. It'll help other listeners find us. The Citizen University National Conference took place at Seattle Center on March 20th and 21st, 2015. Sponsors included Seattle Center, the Seattle Foundation, and KUOW. Thanks again to Anna Tadashev for our recordings. Tune in next week for more great talks. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm John O'Brien.